This episode is brought to you in part by Squarespace, an easy-to-use online platform that helps design, build, and host your website. Squarespace recently launched the latest version of their platform, Squarespace 7, which features a completely redesigned interface and integrations with Getty Images and Google Apps. Try the new Squarespace with a free trial at squarespace.com and enter offer code ONBEING at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Start here. Go anywhere. Mary Oliver is one of our greatest living poets, beloved and often quoted by people across ages and backgrounds. She rarely gives interviews or speaks about the life behind her writing, but she's with us this hour.
Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination. Calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. Lord knows when I started writing poetry, it was rotten.
The poetry was rotten?
Sure. I mean, I was 10, 11, 12 years old. But I kept at it. With my pencil, I've traveled to the moon and back probably a few times.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Mary Oliver was born in 1935 and grew up in a small town in Ohio. She's won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award, among her many honors. She's published numerous collections of poetry and also some wonderful prose. She lived and wrote for 5 decades in Provincetown, Massachusetts on Cape Cod, and her poetry is vivid with a sense of place. After an illness and the death of her longtime partner, the photographer Molly Malone Cook, Mary Oliver has now moved to southern Florida, and that's where I visited her. The question I always start with, whether I'm interviewing a physicist or a poet, is I'd like to hear whether there was a spiritual background to your life, to your early life, to your childhood, however you would define that now.
Well, I would define it now very differently from when I was a child. I was sent to Sunday school, as many kids are, and then I had trouble with the resurrection, so I would not join the church. But I was still probably more interested than many of the kids who did enter the church. It's been one of the most important interests of my life and continues to be. And it doesn't have to be Christianity. I'm very much taken with the poet Rumi, mm-hmm. who is a Muslim, a Sufi poet, and read him every day. And have no answers, but have some suggestions. I know that a life is much richer with a spiritual part to it. Mm-hmm. And I also think nothing is more interesting. So I cling to it.
Right. And then you talk about growing up in a sad, depressed place, a difficult place. I mean, in another, you don't belabor this. I mean, in another place, there's a place you talk about. You were one of many thousands who've had insufficient childhoods. But
yes.
But that you spent a lot of your time walking around the woods.
Yes.
In Ohio.
I did, and I think it saved my life. To this day, I don't care for the enclosure of buildings. Mm-hmm. It was a very bad childhood for everybody, every member of the household, not just myself, I think. And I escaped it, barely, with years of trouble. Yeah. But I did find the entire world in looking for something. But I got saved by poetry, and I got saved by the beauty of the world.
Yeah, and there's such a convergence of those things.
Yes.
Then it seems all the way through.
Yes.
You in your life as a poet.
It is. It is a convergence. And I have a little difficulty now, having lived for 50 years in a small town in the north. I'm trying very hard to love the mangroves.
Well, I know.
takes a while.
I have to say, you and your poetry, for me, are so closely identified with Provincetown and
yes.
and that part of the world and that kind of dramatic weather,
yes.
that kind of shore.
Yes.
And so when I
you know, when I had this amazing opportunity to come visit you, and I said, oh, great, we're going to Cape Cod. No, we're going to Florida.
Yes, well, I just sold my condo to a very dear friend this summer. Mm-hmm. And I bought a little house down here, which needs very serious reconstruction. So I'm not in it yet. But sometimes it's time for the change.
Yeah. Though, for all those years, for decades of your writing, you know, this picture was there of you, this pleasure of walking and writing and, I don't know, standing with your notebook.
Yes.
And actually writing while you're walking.
Yes, that's how I did it.
And it is, and it seems like such a gift that you found that way to be a writer and to have that daily habit.
Well, I don't, as I say, I don't like buildings.
Yeah.
So I was, the only record I broke in school was truancy. I went to the woods a lot with with books.
Right.
Whitman in the knapsack. But I also liked motion. So I just began with these little notebooks and scribbled things as they came to me, and then worked them into poems later. And always, I wanted the I. Many of the poems are I did this, I did this, I saw this. I wanted them, the I, to be the possible reader, mm-hmm. rather than about myself. Mm-hmm. It was about an experience that happened to be mine, but could well have been anybody else's. And that was my feeling about the I. I have been criticized by one editor who felt that the I would be felt as ego. And I thought, no, well, I'm going to risk it and see. And I think it worked. It enjoined the reader into the experience of the poem. I became the kind of person who did the walking and the scribbling,
yeah,
but shared it,
yeah,
if they wanted it. Yes.
And you also use this word, you know, there's this place where you're talking about writing while walking, you know, listening deeply. And I love this, listening convivially.
Yes. Yeah.
And listening really to the world.
Listening to the world. Well, I did that and I still do it. Mm-hmm. I still do it.
I was going to ask you if you thought you could have been a poet in an age when you probably would have grown up writing on computers.
Now? Oh, I very much advise writers not to use the computer.
But it seems to me that more than the computer being the problem, the sitting at a desk would be a problem for
that's
you.
That's a problem. Lots of things are problems. I always, as I talk about in the poetry handbook, discipline is very important.
Yes.
The habit, I think we're creative all day long. And if we have to have an appointment to have that work out on the page, because the creative part of us gets tired of waiting, or just gets tired. And it's helped a lot of students, young poets, doing that, to have that meeting with that part of oneself, because there are, of course, other parts of life. I used to say I gave my, when I had jobs, which wasn't that often, but I'd say I'd give my very best second class
to the
labor to the because I'd get up at 5 and by 9 I'd already had my
right.
my say.
Yeah, and also when you write about that, the discipline that creates space for something quite mysterious to happen. You talk about that wild, silky part of ourselves. With a part of the psyche that works in concert with consciousness and supplies a necessary part of the poem. A heart of the star, as opposed to the shape of the star, let us say, exists in a mysterious, unmapped zone, not unconscious, not subconscious, but cautious.
Where? What is that from?
That's from the poetry handbook.
It's been a while.
It's great, but you promise it learns quickly what sort of courtship it's going to be. You're saying that the writer has to be kind of in courtship with this elusive, essential but elusive, cautious part, and that if you turn up every day, it will learn to trust you.
Yes, I remember
a very
that.
Practical way about talking
the,
about
the,
something
the trust
that's
is very,
quite
is very important.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the creative process.
That is the creative process. It's also true that I believe poetry, it is a convivial and a kind of, I mean, we're it's very old, it's very sacred, it's very wishes for a community. It's a community ritual, certainly. And that's why when you write a poem, you write it for anybody and everybody.
Yeah.
And you have to be ready to do that out of your single self. It's a giving. It's a gift. It's a gift to yourself, but it's a gift to anybody who has the hunger for it.
Right. And I wonder if it's something about, you know, this process you describe where you've applied the will but also the discipline to reach or and also make room for something that's very deep in us, right? I mean, I love this language, this wild, silky part of ourselves. I don't know, maybe yes. The soul.
It's become a nasty word lately.
Because I know it has.
It's become a lazy word.
It's
too bad.
It's cliched.
Yeah. Overused.
So yeah, the silky part, let's just call it that.
Yeah.
But I mean, so that if you, when you offer that, I mean, poetry does create a way to offer that in a condensed
yes.
form,
yes.
vivid form.
And very often, it was Blake who said, I take dictation.
Yeah.
With that discipline and with that willingness and wish to communicate, very often things very slippery do come in that you weren't planning on receiving them.
Right.
But they do happen. It does. I have very rarely, maybe 4 or 5 times in my life, I've written a poem that I never changed. And I don't know where it came from. But it does happen. But it happens among hundreds of poems that you've struggled over.
Yeah.
But it's
do
not.
You know which? Do you know what some of those are? Do you know what they are?
Well, the Percy one was one.
Oh, okay.
The first time Percy came back.
Yeah.
I never changed a word of that. And there are others. Mm-hmm. I can't remember, but mm-hmm. there are a few. Of course, there are also poems that I just write out and then I throw them out.
Right.
Lots of those.
Well, and also, you know, when you talk about this life of waking up in the morning and being outside in this wild landscape and with your notebook in your hand and walking, it's so enviable, right? And but then I know, I mean, when you're in the poetry handbook and there's the discipline of being there, but there's also the hard work of rewriting. And as you say, some things have to be thrown out.
Oh, many, many, many have to be thrown out, for sure.
There's an unromantic part to the process as well.
Well, that's an interesting word. You know, somebody once wrote about me and said I must have a private grant or something that all I seem to do is walk around the woods and write poems. But I was very, very poor.
Mm-hmm.
And I found I ate a lot of fish and a lot of clams.
Right, and I realized that you actually weren't just walking around the woods, you were gathering food.
Yes,
in those early
yes.
years, yep. mussels and clams and mushrooms and yep. berries. Although you gave voice to this kind of really lavish, even ornate beauty that you lived in. That was your daily.
That's how
that
I
was
saw
really
it.
Your mundane world.
Yes, that's true.
So there's a question that you pose in many different ways, overtly and implicitly. You know, how shall I live? In Long Life, you wrote, you know, what does it mean that the earth is so beautiful, and what shall I do about it? What is the gift that I should bring to the world? What is the life that I should live? Which really is a question of moral imagination.
Yes,
and
yeah.
it's the ancient essential question. But I wonder how you think about how that question emerges and is addressed distinctively in poetry. And through poetry, what does poetry do with a question like that, that other forms of language don't?
Well, I think I would disagree that other forms of language don't, but poetry has a different kind of attraction.
Yeah, so what is that attraction in poetry?
I think it's the way it's written. It's the fact that it has been communal for years and years and years, and we've missed it. But I do think poetry has enticements of sound that are different from literature. Literature certainly has it too, or some literature, the best literature. And it has it's easier to, for people to remember. Mm-hmm. People are more apt to remember a poem and therefore feel they own it.
Right.
And can speak it to themselves as you might a prayer. Then they can remember a chapter and quote it. And that's very important because then it belongs to you.
Mm-hmm.
You have it when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
But poetry is certainly closer to singing than prose.
Right, right.
And singing is something that we all love to do or wish we could do.
And it goes all the way through you.
Yes, it does indeed.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, in a rare conversation with the poet Mary Oliver.
I just wanted to read. I just want to read these. This is from Long Life also. The world is fun and familiar and healthful and unbelievably refreshing and lovely. And it is the theater of the spiritual. It is the multiform, utterly obedient to a mystery.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is. We all wonder, who's God? What's going to happen when we die? All that stuff. And I don't think it's... Maybe... It's never nothing. I'm very fond of Lucretius.
Say some more.
And Lucretius says, well, just everything's a little energy. You go back and you're these little bits of energy and pretty soon you're something else. Now, that's a continuance. It's not the one we think of when we're talking about the golden streets and the angels with how many wings and whatever.
Right.
The hierarchy of angels. Even angels have a hierarchy. But it's something quite wonderful that the world is pretty much everything's mortal. It dies, but its parts don't die. Its parts become something else. And we know that when we bury a dog in the garden and with a rose bush on top of it. We know that there is replenishment. And that's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And what more there might be, I don't know, but I'm pretty confident of that one.
And I mean, again, do you think spending your life as a poet and working with words and responding to the world in the way you have as a poet gives you, I don't know, tools to work with? Because putting words around God or what God is or who God is or, you know, I don't know, heaven, it's always insufficient.
It's always insufficient, but the quest and the wonder is not unsatisfying. It's never totally satisfying,
mm-hmm.
but it's intriguing, and also what one does end up believing, even if it shifts, has an effect upon the life that you live or the life that you choose to live or try to live.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an endless, unanswerable quest. So I find it endlessly fascinating. And I think also religion is very helpful in people not thinking that they themselves are sufficient,
mm-hmm.
that there is something that has to do with all of us that is more than all of us are.
And I think, you know, that is what you do, because of the particular vision that you have, what you pay attention to, what you attend to, which is that grandeur, that largeness of the natural world, which, you know, a couple of years ago when I was writing, and I picked up your book, 1,000 Mornings, you know, and here's the first one. I go down to the shore in the morning, and depending on the hour, the waves are rolling in or moving out. And I say, oh, I am miserable. What should I do? And the sea says in its lovely voice, excuse me, I have work to do.
I love that.
And I have to say also, to me, it was just, it's so perfect. It kind of is like, what's the point of writing 50,000, bringing 50,000 new words into the world? This says it all.
Well, I have had a rash, which seems to be continuing, of writing shorter poems. Mm-mm.
I noticed that in your more recent
and
poems.
It probably is an influence from Rumi, whose poems are many of them are quite short. But if you can say it in a few lines, you're just decorating for the rest of it, unless you could intent make something more intense. But if you said what you want to say, you're not going to make it more intense. You're just going to repeat yourself.
Yeah.
So I've got a poem that will start the next book, and I think it goes like this. Things take the time they take. Don't worry. How many roads did St. Augustine follow before he became St. Augustine? Same kind of thing. What else is there to say?
Right.
And, you know, that's four lines, and that's not a day's work. but the poem is done.
And it speaks so completely, perfectly to the eye who's reading the poem, even though it's...
Yeah,
it's about St. Augustine, but it's about all of us, right?
Yeah, and people do worry that they're not
not
wherever they want to go. And St. Augustine, I had just read a biography of him, and he was all over the map before he settled down.
I'd like to talk about attention, which is another real theme that runs through your work, both the word and the practice. And I know people associate you with that word, and but I was interested to read that you began to learn that attention without feeling is only a report, that there's more to attention than for it to matter in the way you want it to matter. Say something about that learning.
You need empathy with it rather than just reporting. Reporting is for field guides, and they're great. They're helpful, but that's what they are. But they're not thought provokers, and they don't go anywhere. And I say somewhere that attention is the beginning of devotion, which I do believe. But that's it. A lot of these things are said but can't be explained.
And yeah, I think your poem "A Summer Day" is one of the best known, and
yes, it is. I would say that's true.
Yeah. So my daughter, who is now 21 and all grown up, but who then was about 12, was assigned to memorize a summer day.
The summer day
in sixth grade. And so she came home reciting this poem, and I felt really embodying it. And we actually played it in the show. Anyway, I brought it because I wanted you to hear it. And so remember, she's not reading it. She'd learned it.
The summer day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the field, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
It's a beautiful reading.
Is that fun for you to hear?
Yeah. How old was she then?
She was about 12.
Yeah. Beautiful.
But so many young people, I mean, young and old, have learned that poem by heart, and it's become part of them.
Yeah. One thing about that poem, which I think is important, is that the grasshopper actually existed, and yet I was able to fit him into that poem. And the sugar he was eating was part of frosting from a Portuguese lady's birthday cake. you know, which wasn't important to the poem.
Right.
But even seeing that little creature come to my plate and say, I'd like a little helping of that.
Right.
It somehow fascinates me that that's just personal for me, that it was Mrs. Segura, probably her 90th birthday cake or something.
Did she ever read the poem? Did she ever know?
No, she was past that.
Uh-huh.
Her daughters may have, but uh-huh. I never advertised myself as a poet. And there was that wonderful thing about the town, and that is, I was taken as somebody who worked like anybody else. And I'd go, there was the one fellow who was the plumber, and we'd maybe meet in the hardware store in the morning.
You mean in Provincetown?
Yeah. And he'd say, oh, hi, Mary, how's your work going? I said, pretty good, how's yours?
Yeah.
And it was the same thing.
Yeah.
There was no sense of eliteness or difference, and that was very nice. I was just, in fact, it is a funny story. When I... The Pulitzer Prize was announced, which I didn't even know they'd turned the book in for it. I was at that time, as the whole town was doing, going out to the dump most mornings, which was a mess. That was before they clean up, to buy shingles. I was shingling the house or some kind of thing.
Right.
And a friend of mine came by, a woman who was a painter, and she said, ha, what are you doing, looking for your old manuscripts? It was very funny.
And you didn't know she'd heard the news?
I knew, but oh. My job in the morning was to go find some shingles.
You can listen again and share this conversation with Mary Oliver through our website, onbeing.org. I'm Krista Tippett. On Being continues in a moment. Today's episode is brought to you in part by Squarespace. They had some exciting news recently when they partnered with actor Jeff Bridges for Squarespace's Super Bowl ad. Jeff Bridges created his website with Squarespace, dreamingwithjeff.com, to feature his new album, Sleeping Tapes. It's an album of relaxing sounds, guided meditations, and stories, and you can listen for free or pay what you want to download. On top of that, all proceeds from the album go to the charity group No Kid Hungry, a national nonprofit working to end child hunger in America. Start building your website on squarespace.com. Enter offer code ONBEING at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, start here, go anywhere. And by The Great Courses, which offers over 500 engaging lectures taught by top professors and experts in their field, including a new course, The Science of Mindfulness, a research-based path to well-being. Insights into how ancient wisdom and traditions, combined with the discoveries of modern science, can work together in everyday life. The Great Courses is a great fit for inquiring on-being listeners who can access the lectures on DVD and CD or use one of The Great Courses apps to both stream and download. For a limited time, The Great Courses has a special offer for On Being listeners. Order from 8 of their best-selling courses, including The Science of Mindfulness, and you get up to 80% off the original price. To order today, go to thegreatcourses.com/onbeing. That's thegreatcourses.com/onbeing. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, the poet Mary Oliver has granted us the honor of a rare interview on the world and poetry and the life behind her writing. She's won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize among her many honors and is beloved by people across ages and backgrounds. At age 79, she's moved from Cape Cod to Florida to be close to friends, and that's where we visited her. I wanted to also name the fact that, yeah, as you said before, you're not somebody who belabors what is dark, what has been hard. I think it's important and maybe helpful for people, because there's so much beauty and light in your poetry, also that you let in the fact that it's not all sweetness and light. And you did that a lot in the Dream Work book.
I did.
And those poems are notably
harder. And a lot of them I didn't know at that time what I was writing about. I really had no understanding.
You mean You didn't realize that they were so hard, or you literally didn't know what you were.
No, there's a poem called Rage.
Yes.
And it says she, and that's perfect biography, unfortunately, or autobiography. But I couldn't handle that material except in the three or four poems that I've done. Just couldn't.
Yeah, I mean, there's a line in Rage: "In your dreams, you have sullied and murdered, and your dreams do not lie."
Yeah.
And that's.
Well, that's how I felt, but I didn't know I was. Certainly, I didn't know I was talking about my father. Children forget. I mean, they don't forget, but they forget the details. They just don't know why they have nightmares all the time. You know, it's very difficult.
Isn't it incredible that we carry those things all our lives?
Well,
decades and decades.
We do carry them, but it is very helpful to figure out, as best you can, what happened and why these people were the way they were.
Yeah.
And it was a very dark and broken house that I came from.
I mean, there's that poem in there, A Visitor, mm-hmm. which mentions your father. And there's just, you know, to me, this heartbreaking line, which also I have my own story. We all do. I saw what love might have done had we loved in time.
Yeah. Well, he never got any love out of me.
Yeah.
Or deserved it. But what makes you angry is the loss of the years of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does leave damage.
Mm-hmm.
But there you are. You do what you can do.
And I think you have such a capacity for joy, especially in the outdoors, right?
Yeah.
And you transmit that, and it's that joy. You know, if you're capable of that, having, you know, how much more of it would there have been?
Well, I saved my own life by finding a place that wasn't in that house.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my strength. But I wasn't all strength. And it would have been a very different life, whether I would have written poetry or not. Who knows?
Yeah.
Poetry is a pretty lonely pursuit. And in many cases, I used to think I don't do it anymore, but that I'm talking to myself. There was nobody else in that house I was going to talk to.
Yeah.
And it was a very difficult time. And a long time. And I don't understand some people's behavior.
But I guess what I'm saying, I think, is that it's a gift that you give to your readers to let that be clear. That this, you know, that your ability to love your one wild and precious life is hard won.
Yeah.
And I mean, I feel like you also, for all the glorious language about God and around God that goes all the way through your poetry, you know, you also acknowledge this perplexing thing. I mean, this was in Long Life. What can we do about God who makes and then breaks every God-forsaken beautiful day?
Well, we can go back and read Lucretius.
What does Lucretius do then?
Well, Lucretius just presents this marvelous and important idea that what we are made of will make something else, which to me is very important. There is no nothingness with these little atoms that run around, too little for us to see, but put together, they make something. Mm. And that, to me, is a miracle. Where it came from, I don't know, but it's a miracle. And I think it's enough to keep a person afloat.
Let's talk about your last couple of books, which also are an insight into you at this stage in your life. And then I'd love for you to read some poems.
Okay.
You have said that you were so captivated, that you were, I mean, I don't know if you've said it this way, but it seems to me you've kind of written about being so captivated by the world of nature that you were less open to the world of humans.
Yes.
And that as you've grown older, as you've gone through life, what did you say? You've entered more fully into the human world.
Yes.
And embraced it. Is that a good,
true. It's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. And was it passage of time? I mean,
It was passage of time as a passage of understanding what happened to me and why I behaved in certain ways and didn't in other ways. So it was clarity.
You wrote really beautifully about the death of Molly.
Yes.
Who you shared so much of your life with. And you wrote, I don't know, I'm finding my notes. The end of life has its own nature also worth our attention.
Yeah.
I liked that line.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it feels to me when I read your poetry of the last couple of years that that's really this territory you're on, or at least
part
of it.
Well, I should be.
I don't mean that the end of life, but just paying attention.
Well, I've been better.
But just a different, it's a different chapter.
It is. I mean, I had cancer a couple of years ago.
Right.
Lung cancer. And it feels that death has left his calling card. I'm fine. I get scanned, you know, as they do. I'm lucky. I'm very lucky. But all the same, you're kind of shocked. You know, this doctor, that doctor. I'm a bad smoker.
And you're still smoking.
Yep. And last time the doctor said, your lungs are good. Well, if you get good fortune, take it. And you keep smoking.
There's that poem, The Fourth Sign of the Zodiac, in the new book.
Yeah, how does that start? Which one is that? One of the poems about cancer.
Have you spoken much about your cancer? I think people know that you were ill.
People knew I was ill, or they didn't know.
They didn't know what it was.
No.
In that poem, there's a very passing reference to it.
Oh, yes, there is. There are four poems. One is about the hunter in the woods that makes no sound, all the hunters.
It's a little bit long, but do you want to read it?
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, where did I put my glasses? Oh. Yeah, the fourth sign of the zodiac is, of course, cancer. Oh, that's what I meant. Why should I have been surprised? Hunters walk the forest without a sound. The hunter strapped to his rifle, the fox on his feet of silk, the serpent on his empire of muscles, all move in a stillness, hungry, careful, intent, just as the cancer entered the forest of my body without a sound. Now, these four poems are about the cancer episode, shall we say? The cancer visit.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want me to go on to these others?
Yeah, you want to go. Is it too much?
No.
Okay.
This is the second poem of these four. The question is, what will it be like after the last day? Will I float into the sky, or will I fray within the earth or a river, remembering nothing? How desperate I would be if I couldn't remember the sun rising, if I couldn't remember trees, rivers, if I couldn't even remember, beloved, your beloved name. 3. I know you never intended to be in this world, but you're in it all the same. So why not get started immediately? I mean, belonging to it. There is so much to admire, to weep over, and to write music or poems about. Bless the feet that take you to and fro. Bless the eyes and the listening ears. Bless the tongue, the marvel of taste. Bless touching. You could live 100 years, it's happened, or not. I am speaking from the fortunate platform of many years, none of which I think I ever wasted. Do you need a prod? Do you need a little darkness to get you going? Let me be as urgent as a knife, then, and remind you of Keats, so single of purpose and thinking for a while, he had a lifetime. 4. Late yesterday afternoon, in the heat, all the fragile blue flowers in bloom in the shrubs in the yard next door had tumbled from the shrubs and lay wrinkled and faded on the grass. But this morning the shrubs were full of the blue flowers again. There wasn't a single one on the grass. How, I wondered, do they roll or crawl back to the shrubs and then back up to the branches, that fiercely wanting, as we all do, just a little more of life?
Krista Tippett, and this is On Being, today with the beloved poet Mary Oliver. There are some of your poems, and I think The Summer Day is one and Wild Geese is another, that have just entered the lexicon.
Yeah, three: The Summer Day, Wild Geese. There's one other. I can't remember, but I would say is the third one. But I don't remember it.
If you think of it, tell me. So Wild Geese is in Dreamwork. Is that a poem? And I've heard people talk about that, Wild Geese, as a poem that has saved lives. And I wonder if when you write something like that, when you wrote that poem, or when you published this book, would you have known that that was the poem that would speak so deeply to people?
This is the magic of it. That poem was written as an exercise in end-stopped lines.
As an exercise in what?
End stopped lines, period, at the end of the line. I was working with a poet. I had her in a class.
So it was an exercise in technique.
Yes. Yes. And it's, not every line is that way. I was trying to show the variation. But my mind was completely on that. At the same time, I will say that I heard the Wild Geese. I just started out to do this for this friend and show her the effect of the line end is you've said something definite. It's very different from enjambment. And I love all that difference. And that's what I was doing.
To your point that the mysteries and that combination of the discipline and the convivial listening.
Yeah, I was trying to do a certain kind of construction. Nevertheless, once I started writing the poem, it was the poem, and I knew the construction well enough that I didn't have to think about, does I have need an end sound line here, or is this where I should be? It just worked itself out the way I wanted for the exercise.
Would you read that one?
Sure. That's a kind of a secret, but but it's the truth. Wild Geese. I actually thought it was, oh no, there it is, 14, you're right. Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination. Calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. Well, it's a subject I knew well a lot about.
Yeah.
You know, so it...
It was
so,
just there in you.
It what?
It was there in
it
you.
It was there in me, yes. And once I heard those geese and, you know, said a line about anguish and where that came from, I don't know. Yeah. I'd say that's one of the poems that...
That just came.
Yeah. It wasn't dictated, but that's what Blake used to say.
Yeah.
And that's just a way of saying you don't know where it comes from.
Yeah.
But if you've done it a lot, and Lord knows when I started writing poetry, it was rotten.
The poetry was rotten?
Sure. I mean, I was 10, 11, 12 years old. But I kept at it. I used to say, with my pencil, I've traveled to the moon and back probably a few times. I kept at it every day, and finally you learn things.
I'm conscious that I want to move towards a close. I'd like to hear a little bit more. I mean, you've mentioned Rumi a few times. In 1,000 Mornings, you say, if I were a Sufi for sure, I would be one of the spinning
dancing
kind.
Yeah.
And that's clear. I mean, that actually it makes so much sense from... Mm-hmm. How you were always on the move, even as a teenager. How do you think your spiritual sensibility, and here we are again with that tricky word, but how has your spiritual, I don't want to say how's your spiritual life, you've said somewhere you've become more spiritual as you've grown older, and I mean, what do you mean when you say that? What's the content of that?
I've become kinder. Mm. More people-oriented, more willing to grow old. I always was investigative in terms of everlasting life, but a little more interested now, a little more content with my answers.
There's this poem... The second poem in 1,000 Mornings, which is your 2013 book, which also to me just kind of, it's like, says it all. What's the point of that? I happen to be standing. Would you read that one?
Oh, yeah.
Which is just, well, there it is.
Yeah. I don't know where prayers go or what they do. Do cats pray while they sleep half asleep in the sun? Does the opossum pray as it crosses the street? The sunflowers, the old black oak growing older every year? I know I can walk through the world along the shore or under the trees with my mind filled with things of little importance in full self-attendance, a condition I can't really call being alive. Is a prayer a gift or a petition? Or does it matter? The sunflowers blaze. Maybe that's their way. Maybe the cats are sound asleep. Maybe not. While I was thinking this, I happened to be standing just outside my door with my notebook open, which is the way I begin every morning. Then a wren in the privet began to sing. He was positively drenched in enthusiasm. I don't know why. And yet, why not? I wouldn't persuade you from whatever you believe or whatever you don't. That's your business. But I thought of the wrens singing. What could this be if it isn't a prayer? So I just listened, my pen in the air. Well, the poems keep coming.
In the Poetry Handbook you wrote, poetry is a life-cherishing force, and it requires a vision, a faith, to use an old-fashioned term. Yes, indeed. For poems are not words, after all, but fires for the cold, ropes let down to the lost, something as necessary as bread in the pockets of the hungry. Yes, indeed. And I just wanted to read that back to you, because I feel like you've given that to so many people. You've demonstrated that. And, you know, you also write in poetry about thinking of Schubert scribbling on a cafe napkin. Thank you. And I feel like so many people, when they read... When they imagine you standing outdoors with your notebook and pen in hand, you know, thank you.
You're welcome. Oh,
it's been a beautiful conversation.
You're much welcome. I'm free.
Yes, you are.
Thank you.
Oliver has received the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. She's published over 25 books of poetry and prose, including Dreamwork, A Thousand Mornings, A Poetry Handbook, and in 2014, Blue Horses. You may know that we usually post the unedited interview behind each week's episode. This 90 Minutes with Mary Oliver contains many lovely moments, including more of her ruminations on her move from the landscape of Cape Cod to that of Florida, and on her long love of the dogs in her life. Have your dogs and your love of your dogs and life with dogs infused your theology? Or is that too lofty a question?
Well, Rilke wrote a poem, a friend of mine did a painting of it, of just a picture of a dog. And the quote is, the soul for which there is no heaven. Hmm. Well, no thank you. I mean, there are going to be trees in paradise, as we're going to have fun imagining it, whether it exists or not. Dogs are certainly going to be there. Poor little burros and donkeys after all the work they've done in the world. Good heavens, yes.
You can listen again or share this episode in many ways, including on your phone through our iPhone and Android apps, on the brand new On Being tablet app, or of course, as always, at onbeing.org. There you can also hear Mary read all the poems you just heard and a few others she read for us. Find all this and much more at onbeing.org. On Being is Trent Gilliss, Chris Heagle, Lily Percy, Mariah Helgeson, David Shimke, Nikki Oster, and Selena Carlson. Special thanks this week to Anne Godoff and Liz Calamari at Penguin Press and to Regula Nutzli at the Charlotte Sheedy Literary Agency. Our major funding partners are the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. The Fetzer Institute, fostering awareness of the power of love and forgiveness to transform our world. Find them at fetzer.org. Calliopeia Foundation, contributing to organizations that weave reverence, reciprocity, and resilience into the fabric of modern life. And the Osprey Foundation, a catalyst for empowered, healthy, and fulfilled lives.
On Being is distributed by American Public Media and is a Krista Tippett Public production.